that there shall be no religious test for public office. So you have to read
that. So the question was,
if you hold hands when you interrupt,
that'll be better. Right.
That will work.
The question is, though, and it's a good one, is how do you, if rights emanate from God, if you have this worldview that says freedom, liberty, are a gift from God to mankind, which was very much with what John Locke taught. I mean, Jefferson didn't make this up. I mean, this was something that was taught very much during this period of time in world history. This idea that these transcendent truths, these values, emanate from a source other than the government. I think it's really important that students understand that, because you don't want a situation, and I think the ACLU, I know, would share this position. They may not share the God portion of it, but you don't want the government in the position of saying your freedom, your liberty, your rights of speech or protest can be completely shut off because the government disagrees. Now, where it gets murky or more difficult is not when it's speech, because we could all agree about speech issues, but when you get to issues where there's competing values, like abortion, and that you have the right of the woman seeking access for abortion, and then you have others that share a view that I have, that there's another life involved in this. This is not a one-person process. There's conflicting lives at issue here, and how you balance those. And those become more difficult. And
what about another current issue like pharmacists not willing to fill prescriptions based on religious beliefs? It sounds like whether you believe it or not, emanating from God, not
shut the hell up, John Sicolo. I guess it's all right to bomb you and your rhetoric out of existence. This nonsense about some of y'all believe that freedom and liberty are rights from God. Why didn't you tell the millions of slaves that? Or how about the native Aboriginal people that you were extinguishing out of existence? And then you're talking about how you don't want the government to tell you about or provide you for your freedom and liberty. Of course we don't want a wretched government like this, but we sure the hell don't want some pope or some silly imam or cleric or preacher man or whatever Wizard of Oz who's basically a parasitic ambassador to your invisible kingdoms outlining how we should conduct our lives. As a matter of fact, that's not living. That's just another form of slavery. Well, you know what type of response we have to that, and all types of slavery. Slave revolt. Check it out. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, the world, radioforall.net, universe, and click into your Slave Revolt blog by tapping in your Google web, Slave Revolt Radio. Tonight, we're going to explore the real martial law. Martial law and the black experience, and what it truly means to deal with this type of madness. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Seekers everywhere, I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure
You know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, what we're going to shoot our way into is, there's many things that are going on within this particular society and how people are trying to deal with them at hand. We have an issue where what the core of black people have historically faced and are currently facing seems somehow not to register within certain portions of this population as being something real or something that one can at least somewhat learn something from. We're going to explore this a little bit. What we're going to deal with is martial law and the black experience. We often hear nowadays how people are screaming out, martial law is coming. And be ready and tell all your friends in the internet and so on and so forth. But there's some things that have been taking place currently and historically, which should give some people insight to these types of martial law type orders that black people have been inflicted with. Rafael Perez found himself in the midst of a scandal with the LAPD over basically getting caught initially stealing 6 pounds of cocaine. He tried to plea bargain himself out, basically by oinking out on his fellow police friends to reduce his sentence and make it so that the maximum he can get for any type of crime he committed amongst the masses would be 5 years, barring that any of his crimes were murder. We're going to play some stuff from Rafael Perez as he gave his various confessions and outlines on what he and his comrades in Imperial Arms did to the black and Latino masses. And then we're going to explore some of the concepts of who's really already facing forms of martial law. So first off, let's check out Perez as he outlines some of the strategies and techniques that went down with him and his little rampart unit in the LAPD. Check this out.
On this occasion, I'm looking out the window. I have my earpiece on for my radio. We always wore earpieces. Minutes before the actual radio call that we put out and shooting, I hear Durden talking. I know on the report it says that we heard a bang and somebody ran through the door or whatever. That didn't occur. But I hear Durden saying voice, and that's when it took my attention. Then I hear like a fuck. I don't mean curse it. It's like a, you know, like, I don't know exactly what was said, but it's like there was a fuck in there, you know, and some other words. That's when I turned around and started walking toward where Durden was. Obviously you've seen the diagram. The rooms, I believe it's the kitchen on this side, then a threshold to a door, or where it would be a door, and then the living room. And then there's a chair, was it term chair? Okay. From where I was at the window, and I started walking toward Durden.
Which window were you at?
I had the diagram. Okay, the threshold that separates the two rooms.
Okay.
The first window right there. Right there.
Okay.
Good.
Kitchen.
Yeah, it's a kitchen window.
Okay.
I don't know if there's more than one window, but it's the first window from the threshold. As I walked back towards where Durden was and his voice talking, is where I see Durden. As I'm walking towards Durden, when I see him pulling his gun out, and he's left-handed. So I can see him, I can see his left side, I can see him like reaching, coming up with his weapon. I come up with my weapon. Durden points out, I'm watching him, I'm coming up. Durden fires one round. I fire what I thought was one round. One round, but it turns out to be, I think I fired three rounds.
Yes.
I told the shooting team that I fired one, and then they counted my rounds, and it was, I think they said three or four. Three. Right after that occurred, Mr. Obando is laying on the floor. His head was closest to the door, the entrance, the actual door. I stayed covering down on the Mr. Obando. Officer Durden walked out the door. He was looking around, seeing if there's anybody else or whatever. A few minutes pass. He comes back and produces, and if my mind serves me absolutely correct, and I believe it does, there was a red, very dirty shirt that was had the weapon wrapped in. He stands right next to, and very little words were said. Very few words. I mean, I don't even remember what was said. Myself and Durden. Durden stands right where the defendant would have been standing, takes the weapon, holding the rag and the weapon, and drops it from chest level down to the ground and lets it fall. This is the one thing that doesn't, I don't remember exactly sure whether we called, I'm positive that we called the crash units first before we called an ambulance. I mean, we had talked about that before. I'm almost positive that we called the crash units, and the first unit that showed up was Rios and Montoya. I believe it was Officer Rios who handcuffed the defendant. Officer Durden, he was also the one who called the RA. Officer Durden, during this whole thing, I guess maybe assumed more of the responsibility because he was doing everything. I don't know if you can tell in the OIS report, he did all the talking. When they first got there, he wanted to do all the talking, wanted to do all the, even though I was a senior officer, this is one of those few times where he wanted to get everything out, first. And we just went with the story. Well, I just went with the story.
So as you can see, basically, how this whole setup played itself out was Perez and his little partner shoot this cat, and he just goes with the flow, meaning Perez, with whatever his partner has to say. And it's not like it's a situation where they are both put into separate rooms or anything, and then they make sure that their stories match up. Basically, his little partner outlines what happens in front of him and in front of the supervisors, and then he just nods his head and goes along with it. So the fact that they ended up shooting this unarmed person and then just dropping a gun on him really doesn't make any difference, because Perez is not going to be questioned in any kind of diligent way separately. So it's all set up for their stories to match up and to collaborate with each other, because they're not really being questioned in that way. In other words, it's all designed for the extermination of the particular people that they are dealing with, i.e. within the Black and Latino community. So everything is set up for these raggedy cops to basically do at will within the community, and they will be protected by the law, because the law is set up to crush the masses within the community and to protect them in any falsification that they happen to explore. So you can see how cynical this whole process is, and how someone like Perez could actually have so much confidence in what he's doing, because there is not in any way any kind of procedure, so to speak, to protect the masses of people. Basically, we're just at within their crosshairs, outside of what we can develop and defend for ourselves. But let's now move on to what else Perez has to say about this whole episode and procedures that were taking place at hand in his little unit. Check it out.
When we have this meeting, we're covering. We're covering procedures, all the logistics I mentioned earlier. And when I say logistics, I mean the tactics, the communication, the tactics, to where the shooting occurred. Everything is covered in that meeting before all the other supervisors and captains and everybody show up, and the officer involved shooting team. You know how everybody thinks that the officers are split up, and you go sit in one room and you go sit in another room. I've never seen it happen. You get together with the supervisor and the other officers involved, and you discuss everything, and then that's your story. And
when did you and Durden get your story together about what happened?
The story went as everything occurred. That was what happened, as far as we were concerned. In other words, where we fired from, that stayed true to form as to how it happened.
Mr. Orlando coming into the room. When did you guys get that together?
That actually came together when Durden was, like I said earlier, that Durden was doing all the talking. Remember, I told you that Durden was doing all the talking. And I just listened to him. And as he was telling the story to our team, I'm going, okay, that's exactly how it happened. Yes.
See, as you heard, they didn't split him up. He goes, okay, yeah, if he said that's how it happened, that's how it happened. This is just a joke. But see, it gives one the impression, or not really the impression, it gives one a clearer view of what, like, Black and Latino communities have to face. This is why, you know, it's kind of a joke for many Black people to see these little guys ramble on in the internet about martial law is coming, martial law, because Black people have always had to win under the Black experience in America. Have Black people not face some form of martial law, whether you're talking about slavery itself or the crushing of the Reconstruction period and the implication that ended up being created through the Jim Crow laws, the war on drugs, the war on crime, war on poverty. These are all various forms of martial law order in place against the Black community. The whole NUKIL program and counterintelligence program were designed by an order, a ruling class order, to crush the rights and to shore up and implement in all kinds of rigid control by the state. Justice has nothing to do with it. It's about power, organized power, capital power versus Black collective organized power, development, expansion. Now, somehow Black people, through all of the crises, at times disasters, heartfelt assassinations, etc., has still been able to navigate our way through this wretched madness by the imperial class. And one would think, how some people would think, how are they still able to operate, since they face the martial law type stuff that we never can comprehend of? I mean, it's, but you could tell that most communities and activists don't even think towards looking at the Black experience as part and parcel of something that should be looked at and studied to understand how to navigate one's way through and, in the end, crush the rulers within the society that are registering such calamity on the population. But instead, what you get are, you know, one little Alex Jones documentary, martial law, this martial, you know, after another, when that reality has been crushing at black people's necks since we've been brought over to this wretched place. The whole aspect of destroying the job, the industrial base within the black community is in form, is a form of attack by the ruling class to create chaos, to then ratchet up more vicious laws, lock down communities. There's many complexes, you know, projects, stuff like that, where you have to have a certain type of ID to even go into or around those complexes. There are certain areas in the neighborhood at times when the police, all of a sudden you see they have barricades out. And they're searching any and everyone's ID who's either coming in or out of that particular section of the community. This is all mechanisms of a martial law order. And we're not talking about in the future. This has been happening for years. Now, it's under the pretense of, you know, war on drugs, war on crime, war on poverty, war. It's war on black. It's a martial law order on black. But next, let's see how Perez goes into some of his next chain of events as him and his other operatives were operating in the LAPD. Check this out.
The next question, before we get back to the shooting incident we talked about at the court, is there any other police officer who either you know was engaged in criminal conduct or you believe might have been engaged in criminal conduct based on what you saw that you've not identified so far?
I'm going to make a very broad statement, and you're not going to like it. It's not good. There's a thing called being in the loop, being involved. I was not in the loop or involved in anything as far as police-wise for maybe 95 when I joined Crash. When I got into Crash before then, I had no concept of what certain officers do. I can tell you this, and you can put me on a polygraph. Oh, I know I'm going to be on a polygraph, but... Oh, I know. And I can say this, and you can ask me this directly in the polygraph. I would say that 90% of the officers that were crashed, and not just Rampart Crash, falsify a lot of information. They put cases on people. And I know that's not a good thing to hear. I know it's very broad. The first time I, you know, saw certain things, I didn't realize it, like I said, till 95 when I joined Crash 95. I didn't see a lot of these things. I just did. I was a patrol guy, worked narcotics, just did my normal job. But, and I'm not, number one, proud of this, or, you know, it hurts me to say it, but there's a lot of crooked stuff going on with LAPD. Especially LAPD specialized units. You go to the shortstop and you hear, you know, 77th crash and Rampart crash get into shooting. We snoopy up at the benches up in the academy and we talk about how things went down, how they really went down, and how they were fixed up. Whether it's Sonny Garcia's shooting of working narcotics, supposedly the gun suspect went after his gun when actually he was running after the guy and the gun went off accidentally. There's so many incidences. I couldn't possibly go into every one of them because I can't really remember all of them. What I'm saying is, specialized units need to be looked at because there it is. And believe me when I tell you, if there was 15 officers in Crash, 13 of them were putting cases on people.
When you say putting cases on people, do you mean manufacturing probable cause, or do you mean actually, in essence, framing somebody who did not do something for a crime?
Both.
All right, so once again, You hear Perez talk about, in a broad statement, it's about being in the loop. And the crash unit that he was involved in, part of this whole Rampart, and crash was in other departments too, which is Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, crash. 90% of the work by these cops was falsified information. In other words, they were lying, distorting, dropping guns on people, falsifying information to destroy people's lives 90% of the time. Now, there's no way that that can be considered an accident. This isn't an operation. Now, these little street punk cops may not know or understand the overall picture of what's going on, but that's not really necessary. In the same way that a grunt that's over in Iraq right now may not understand the overall goal and interest of the ruling class that he or she's getting his leg blown off for, and is spreading depleted uranium all over the soil of the Iraqi people. They're just, you know, grunts. So are the little police. They may be in it for their own machismo purposes, or just like to shoot up Negroes. Whatever the particular case is, they may not and don't need to understand the overall picture. But it's clear that when you have 90% in these particular specialized units operating in this particular way, no one can even pretend that these pigs are out there to quote-unquote serve the people's interests. This is there as a martial law order against the black community, and is there to crush the resistance and soul of black folks. That's what this is all about. And it's interesting how you know, these are specialized units. And in a way, these specialized units is that, let me put it in this context. If you go to like within like East Oakland or North Oakland or West Oakland and want to blather on about who and why Malcolm was killed in this day and age, basically you'll get slapped side your head. Because see, black people know that in their guts that while Malcolm was killed during a certain period in time, the state has progressed in its vicious diabolical tentacles far beyond what was taking place in the 1960s. In other words, black people are being slaughtered intentionally and being targeted well before they can even reach or come close to a Malcolm or even a social conscious level now. They're intentionally being targeted. There's this brother in South Central LA who basically just wanted to work with the gangs and get a truce going. This was after the Rodney King riots, and then wanted to, you know, set up like a little pirate radio hookup. He got targeted. Now, he was nowhere near being fully developed and having a consciousness from a revolutionary perspective of, you know, of the capitalist class or any of that type of stuff. He just wanted basically a gang type truce and kind of a community outreach type of situation in the community. But these specialized units are so far more developed than what they were in the 1960s that if you don't have certain types of personal self-defense mechanisms and hookups and collectives and things like that, you can easily be knocked out the box well before a person hopes to even develop in towards having a more universal understanding of what's going on, because the state has progressed so far. And black people know this. They may not even be from a standpoint fully developed and can tell you, you know, every little law that's being passed by the state. A while back when Alexander Coburn was doing a presentation in Richmond to the black community over the crack cocaine and how it entered into the communities and stuff like that, it was kind of connected with what Webb was doing at the time. And Richmond was another city that had been hit hard by this particular process. I went and set up a little station at the church in Richmond to give sisters and brothers an idea of how they could start their own station in the neighborhood and have these types of discussions and programs all the time on a community level instead of just having it on this one particular thing. And people who couldn't make it to hear the discussion could actually hear these types of discussions on how to combat the pigs, the FBI, the state in general, the corporate media that sponsors out all of this propaganda, and how politicians work in cahoots with all those entities that pass more and more repressive martial law type orders in the black communities so that the armed fist of the state, the police, can go out and enforce them. Now, as I was setting it up, I was approached by a couple of different sisters and brothers saying, you know, be careful, you know what you're doing, and, you know, so on and so forth. Now, they didn't even happen to know me and stuff, but they understood that it's beyond shooting, quote unquote, a Malcolm when he develops in a certain or to a certain period, you know, back in the 1960s, that this thing with their specialized units that crash is really all about and is there for is to make sure that black people don't get their heads up again, and any and all entities that try to, and even those that aren't, need to be shot and crushed into the earth by any means. Now, that's what black people have been facing in the real world. One doesn't need to go into ozone land to find that out. But still we rise. Now let's listen next to what Perez has to say about some of the other deeds him and his comrades have been engaged in. Check this out.
The Rampart Crash Unit motto, the current motto, was we intimidate those who intimidate others. That was our motto. The motto before I got there, and I don't know if you can check the books or whatever, when a three strikes thing came out, their goal and their motto was that they will have a record for putting more third strikers in jail than any other unit, no matter how they did it. Their forte and what, you know, when you get into a unit, they always tell you the history of the unit. You know, we have roll call meetings, and here's where this unit came from. You know, here's what we stand for, and this is what we do, and this is Rampart Crash, and it's been a long history of Rampart Crash. And their motto and their forte back then was that we're going to put more third strikers in jail than anybody. Bottom line. And that's what they bragged about. You know, the Richardsons, the Lujans, the all the officers that were there from, you know, 93, 94, you know, that's what they were doing. That was their thing. They put a lot of people in jail.
And when you say by any means, does that mean by planting evidence, perjured testimony, falsifying probable cause, those types of things?
All the above, yes.
So once again, you see how, you know, these three strikes and all of that type of stuff, which many people don't really think too much about it. Oh, it's bad. It's unfair. Many of these people, you know, the third strike wasn't a violent offense. You know, maybe we should get rid of it and all of that type of stuff. What black folks have to face is that these guys intentionally use the three strikes to put away black people for life, regardless in how and whatever means it takes. So what Perez was talking about was that 90% thing. If you got to falsify information, falsify information. If you got to drop a gun on someone, drop the gun. In other words, whatever it takes to frame up someone and get these people off the streets, that's what you have to do. Now, if you connect it with this 90% type of operation of where he admits that these people in this crash unit frame up people, this is obviously not the so-called drug dealers in the neighborhood. This is all a charade. It's a farce. This is targeting the community at large. This is nothing but part of a martial law order against the black community as part of a whole covert operation that has its continuance with the New Kill program under Nixon, the counterintelligence program, and all of the other historical types of barbarity that black people have faced since we've been here in this wretched soil under slavery, under Jim Crow, etc. Now, he's talked about how they had a motto that we intimidate those who intimidate others. This is not that much unlike the cops in New York. Remember these cops under Giuliani? They formed this war on guns task force. Now, what their motto was, we own the night, which basically means, nigga, if we see you on the streets at night, we'll kill you. In other words, it was just another death squad. And that's what we're facing. That's what we've been facing. So Amadou is trying to enter into his house. The cops see him. The cops point their guns. Four guns pointed at Amadou with a key and a wallet in his hand. They say the key looked like a gun. No, it was a wallet that looked like a gun. The key, the wallet, 41 bullets later, bye-bye Amadou. That's the hardcore reality that black people were facing, all under the various pretexts of these war on this, war on drugs, war on crime, war on poverty, war on, it's a war, a martial law order, war on us. That's the real world, and that's what we continuously deal with.
You know something, man? This cat Perez, to show you how connected he is, I saw a film on the assassination of Tupac and Biggie. And Tracy, I'm not sure now, but I believe that this guy Perez was one of Tupac's bodyguards. Do you recall? I'm serious about this.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. I'll check on that again. I mean, because he didn't. I don't even think he did 5 years. By the way, I think
he
did two.
He got out 2 years earlier.
Yeah, Mike. Well, this should not be. Look, let's just think a little deeper about this too. What could be going on in anybody's mind when they go to a police evidence locker and just try to walk out with pounds and pounds of cocaine? What could be going through their mind? The fix was should have been in. Wrong guy working that night. I don't know what could be going through their mind, but that, you know, that just shows you, like, what the psychopathic nature of the police.
So next, Perez goes into some of the other experiences him and his comrades in arms were engaged in. Check this out.
I have worked with certain groups in other aspects. He comes to all our mug parties. The plaque that you probably saw in my house with the... Do you know what that plaque is even about? That crash plaque with has the two red cards with a red heart and two bullets in it.
Aces and eights?
Yeah, aces and eights. Do you guys know what that is?
What is that for?
Sergeant Hoops made me that plaque for the Obando shooting. That's what that is. We give plaques out when you get involved in shootings. If the guy dies, the card is black number two. If he stays alive, it's a red number two. I don't know if you guys knew that or not.
Just to get one that's black and white?
I'm assuming so. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, the black one signifies that the guy died. The red one means that it was a hit, but not fatal.
Now, this is what I mean by the death squad situation. For these cops in Rampart, like Perez, when they're engaged in shootings, they get a plaque. Now, he just told you that 90% of the time earlier that, you know, they're just falsifying stuff. They drop guns on people, you know, frame them up. You know, it's called drop guns and all of that type of stuff. On the plaque, it has a card. If the guy stays alive, it's a red. You know, the playing cards. It's a red, you know, whatever. And if it's black, it means the guy has died. In other words, they're just taking notches on their belt. This is just a modern day notch on the belt, like some modern day vigilante gunslingers. It has nothing to do with whether these people are innocent or not, quote unquote innocent or not, because the whole community is being targeted. So you didn't see him differentiate about, well, if it was quote-unquote a gang member who had a known history of violence and we killed him, then we would get a plaque, you know, with a card in it. Nah, is this find a Negro, any Negro, lynch a Negro. If you lynch the Negro successfully, then, hey, you get a black card. If he happens to live, unfortunately, he gets a red one. So this is how these death squad works. Now, he mentioned the name of this one, a Vando. And he mentioned Durden, who was involved. Now, Durden was the guy who was before in the beginning talking about him making up the story, and Perez just went along with it. Now, what ended up happening was, among the first revelations when Perez told investigators on how he and his partner, Nino Durden, had shot, framed, and testified against Javier Avando, the guy he just mentioned. He was a quote-unquote unarmed gang member who was left paralyzed as a result of the incident. At the time of Perez's admission, Avando was in jail serving the 23-year sentence he had received for allegedly assaulting the two officers. So what ended up happening was Javier Avando was shot and paralyzed by these cops. They planted the gun on him. They lied in court saying that they were attacked and, you know, and all this type of stuff. They get their red card because he didn't die, but it was a shooting. It turns out that Avando was unarmed and that they just gunned him down. He's paralyzed. He has served like 2 years of his 23-year sentence. And he ended up getting a few million dollars for this particular illegal shooting. Illegal in quotes. Shooting. But he was paralyzed. His life basically was ruined. And if it hadn't been for this punk cop Perez getting caught stealing all of those all that cocaine out of the locker room, this case, like many others, it ended up being over 100 other cases where they had to exonerate people. And the reason why I say exonerate, you can't exonerate someone if they're, I mean, well, you can technically, but if they're in a coffin, what does it really matter? But there was over 100 cases where they had to exonerate people. So either let them out of jail or just quote unquote scrub their name off from being a quote unquote criminal. But the whole point is that the mission was accomplished and continues to be accomplished under this martial law order within the black experience. But now, Perez goes on to detail some of the other systematic techniques and strategies that they have in store for black. Check it out.
Now, what you just implied, and I just want to understand if I'm taking this correctly, you guys would come with guns or other property at times and not book it. In the sense of the guns, Was that so that you kept them as drop guns for bad shootings?
Yes. Or sometimes it was just a matter of not wanting to book it because there's no body with it, so why book it?
Well, what would you keep these guns?
Anyway, you know, officers keep it. Officers carry war bags, maybe not now with everything that's going on. But if you did a random sweep, one time there was a sweep done because somebody had said that somebody was carrying illegal bullets, you know, back in the day before the slugs or whatever, we were allowed to carry them. I mean, they had every unit come into the station and search their trunk, you know. If you were to do that to the crash unit on one occasion, you would be amazed at what you would find in the officer's war bag. I mean, like Durden was carrying that bag in one of his backpacks in his war bag, and this was a pretty big gun, if I remember correctly, the Tech 22. But he has, you know, backpacks with binoculars in it and tape, and he's one of those handy guys where he carries everything in these little bags. But, officers would just carry them in their... There's a war bag, what we call a war bag, and carry that in the back of your black and white. And end of the night, you just throw it in your locker or in the back of your truck, you know, in the parking lot, and just check it.
So basically, what Perez is talking about there is that the cops carry what are called war bags. Now, black folks know this in the community. And inside those bags, they have all types of stuff. They got guns. They got drugs in the bag. In the case of Durden, his former partner, or one of his former partners, he kept a Tech 22, binoculars, tapes. This is, because they do sadistic type stuff too. They torture people all the time. They'll make certain girls perform sexual activity towards them. There's no level that these cats won't go to. And the state intentionally has some of the most sadistic pinhead devils out there roaming our particular streets under as much protection by the law and state as humanly possible. So the mere fact that Perez terms it, and it's a correct term, it's a war bag, that gives you an idea of their whole mindset when they come into the communities and what this is all about. This is a war on us. It's not a coincidence that he didn't use a term like, or they have serve and protect bags. Nah, they know that this is just rhetoric. This is war. And the particular rights that black people have been able to ascertain has been the types of rights that we have been able to crush out of the earth through our own efforts of self-defense, our own development and understanding that of what the hell is going on in this wretched society that has been part, deeply part of the black experience.
And you know what else? I think people don't realize, when you listen to this outrageous information, there's a tendency for people to kind of say, oh, well, you know, no big deal. I mean, you know, this is what you got to stop the terrorists. But what people don't understand is that this actually predated 9-1-1. This predated that. This type of activity was going on long before those Twin Towers went down. So, and the mentality, see, could they tested the mentality and the constant and the moral strength of America by using this in the black community. Will people accept the unconstitutional behavior of the police? And basically, the answer was yes. That is, by making the argument, look, folks, we just want to protect everybody from these gangsters, these kill crazy gangsters. We can't respect the law in the normal way when dealing with these people. This is what the cops say to their liberal monitors, who's ever supposed to be watching them when they do. If we give these guys the normal rights that we give any other citizen, we'd never be able to bring them under any control. So we have to cut a few corners. Don't you understand? We love this country. This is America. You know, this is the kind of argument that the chief of police would make. And what do you get? This is what it means. So they never did any of this activity or formed any of these groups without those same Democratic Party politicians that claim to represent us, including the black ones, knowing in advance what was going to happen. Because this is not new, brothers and sisters. Look, let's take another simple example. Mumia Abdul-Jamal was framed up on the basis and sent to the death row on the basis that he was a member of the Panthers. That's what they said. You and the Panthers, so therefore, this is why you kill those two, the police, they say. They claim. Well, they actually got a jury to go along with it. He's on death row right now. Understand, that was 1981. Today, you see, they have advanced and degenerated a little more so that through the Patriot Act, they have made it a law that they do not have to really prove that you have a motive when they call you a terrorist. The government just calls you a terrorist. They don't have to prove it. You don't get access to a lawyer anymore. And that's the case of Jose Padilla. You see, so this stuff, what he's talking about here, is actually very important because, remember, this predates 9-1-1.
Well, Perez was arrested. Perez was arrested in August of 1998, and that's when the whole Rampart thing first broke out. And it's interesting because Perez, when he was first stopped and arrested by some little detectives, his question was, "Is this about the bank robbery?" And and basically, the bank robbery episode happened in November of 1997 when robbers targeted a L.A. branch of the Bank of America, making off with $722,000. Investigating cops were suspicious of the assistant bank manager. Her name was Erlyn Romero, who had more cash than was necessarily delivered just 10 minutes before the robbery. A month later, Romero confessed to her role in the crime and implicated her boyfriend, David Mack. LAPD officer, David Mack, as the mastermind. Now, Mack was arrested and later convicted of the robbery. He was sentenced to 14 years and 3 months in federal pen. 14 years for a bank robbery. And this is after he refused to reveal the whereabouts of the money. So he said, "No, I ain't telling you where the money is." And they still only give him 14 years. So, Mack was a friend and confidant of Rafael Perez. He actually saved Perez's life one time. And that weekend of the robbery, the two went, along with their girlfriend and wife, went to Las Vegas to gamble, spending thousands of dollars. Now, Perez was never convicted or charged with any of the bank robbery stuff. Now, this right there helps once again show that they got these cops running around robbing banks and all of this type of stuff, and they had the nerve to pretend that our communities are the vices. But they know all of this corruption's going on. It's all a farce. They know that this is not about stopping crime or anything. This is all about stopping us through their various martial law order. Now, next, Perez goes into some of the more experiences that him and his inklings were dealing out on us. Check it out.
See what it is. There's people that they get off on turning witnesses, or turning people into informants, or, you know, I can get this guy to roll over. I can get this guy to do this. Hewitt has a thing for beating up people. That's just his thing. He would rather beat you up. Let's say he catches you dirty. He would rather beat you up, beat you to a pulp, and it's okay, we're even now, right? You know, you didn't go to jail. I beat you up, I let you go, and we're even. Let's say just, okay, I got you dirty, let's go, you're going to jail. He'd much rather give you a break and beat you to a pulp than to arrest you. It's just his thrill. It's what he gets off on. I mean, I don't know how else to put it to you as far as... When all this first started, I had said how I fear certain officers, and Hewitt is one of them. Hewitt is very, very, very dangerous. I mean, he is, you know, if I would have had to categorize him as a, let's say he's a criminal. You know, you have those criminals who see an old lady and they take their purse and start running and just, you know, they got their purse. He's the kind that would knock her over, make her fall, break her head, then take her purse and go. That's the type, that's where I put Hewitt.
Okay, now next, Perez was talking about something that many of us know about. The super sadistic cops in the neighborhood. Hewitt is one of these types, where if he catches you on the street, they arrest you. They don't just challenge you to a fight, you know what I'm saying? This, you know, he don't take off his gun or basically both of you unstrap your guns and then just go at it toe-to-toe. Basically, they'll have you arrested, all, you know, handcuffed up, take you down to the station where there's like 50 cops all surrounding you, you know, Abner Louima style. And then he starts his sadistic beatings of you, you know, beats you up into your kidneys and stomach till you vomit up blood and all of that type of stuff. And that's the type of cop Hewitt is. As Perez was saying, that this type of cop was a cop that he feared. This is Perez saying he feared the type of Hewitt cop. Now, in Chicago, you got the John Burge, you know, the type that tortures you with, you know, this electro generator, et cetera, et cetera, and on and on and on. The writers, certain ones, are in a similar mode where if they catch you out deep in, you know, West Oakland and stuff with no protection, by yourself, where you can't shoot back, with no protection, they got you outnumbered, then here they come, superheroes then. And certain ones will, you know, get into this sadistic type of beat downs and et cetera, and drive you around town, you know, all this Rodney King type stuff. This is what we deal with. Now, there's no amount of laws on the book that really protect black people, because it happens all over the place. From Oakland to Richmond, South Central LA, to Chicago, is basically all on black people. So this is why I talk, you know, when you see these little super revolutionary types wanting to blather on and on about the quote-unquote new world order coming down and make little documentaries, bring your little asses on down to where we're at. You'll see something that will spin your little head off if you survive it. But next, Perez moves on about some of the other technique and strategies that are employed in this New World Order. Really, it's just a world order of traditional magnitudes on black.
S.O.S.
I didn't like Nino. I never really liked Nino. And you know how you guys are wondering whether we were real friends? We're not friends. We just worked together. I never went out with him, went out, I never did. I didn't want him in the unit. I just didn't like his attitude. I just never did.
What
did
you like about his attitude?
He came back from, you know, he was a probationer down at 77th Crash, or he worked this last few months down at 77th Crash. He had the 77th Crash tattoo. He came down to Rampart, you know, and 77th, this is how we do it. That type of attitude, you know, wearing a 77th Crash jacket at Rampart now, you know, just something I just didn't really, you know, you see each other, you kind of stand off when you're walking down the hallway, look at each other like, but my girlfriend, or my wife and his girlfriend knew each other. He kept asking my wife to get him in the unit. So basically, in the way the unit works, you either sponsor somebody or you vote him in. I sponsored him in. I said, when you sponsor somebody, that means you will work with him. If he screws up, you'll get rid of him. That type of thing. I mean, get rid of him out of the unit, you know, saying, listen, we tried it, it didn't work out, you have to go. So when you sponsor somebody, you have to work. That is your part, because you're vouching for him. And I'm sorry.
Up until before, I believe it was May of 1997, I have never, ever taken $20 from a narcotics dealer, never, ever sold any narcotics, never committed a crime. I don't know what it was, but Durden just had this way of saying things that was kind of very influential. He would say things to you like the very first time we had made a bus, and I told him, hey, put the money and those drugs on the record report. And he called me and he goes, he's like, oh, no, it's here. And I'm like, yeah? You ain't got a book all of it. And he said it in a manner which everybody's doing it.
What's interesting is you hear how this mechanism works once again. And as Perez says, you have to sponsor someone to get into the crash unit. And if you sponsor them to get into the crash unit, then you have to work with them. So you already have a specialized counterintelligence world order force against, martial law force against black people. And it's set up to disenfranchise and destroy black people. Then you sponsor someone in and they have to work with you. And if they don't act right, so to speak, then you, it's up to you to get rid of them. Well, obviously, this is only going to perpetuate and intensify the indoctrination of injustices against black people, the barbarity that's used against black people in the communities. This is all by design. Now, the people who set up these crash units, the politicians that went along with the flow, the administrators, the district attorneys, they know that this is a corrupt way to set up any kind of unit, that the only way to get into this particular type of unit is to be sponsored in and a type of coercive effect. But see, that's because this is all a facade that they're here to do anything other than to crush us into the ground. But next, Perez goes on. And, oh wait, let me just say this also. The needle darting guy, he was in a different crash unit, the 77 crash unit. And he had his little 77 tattoo and a crash unit tattoo and jacket and so on and so forth. So they didn't really like each other so much. But at the end of the day, they worked hand in hand in destroying as many black and Latino lives as possible. As Perez continues on in this martial law experience in the black community.
One question I think everyone will be interested in, and we only have a couple minutes, is do you know anything about the bank robbery with men? Are you involved in any way?
I've said this from the beginning and early on. In fact, when the FBI agents came to interview me, without an attorney, I offered to take a polygraph right then and there. They said, no, that's not necessary. I did not know anything prior, during, or after. When David Mack was arrested, I was as surprised. In fact, my wife called me because there was a press release. I hadn't heard about it. I was as surprised as anybody. Supposedly, we went to Vegas together 2 days or 3 days after the bank robbery. He gave no indication that he had done anything. As a matter of fact, we were calling him cheap because he only put in like 10 bucks towards the gas. And, you know, I used my truck. And in fact, he was not going to go to Vegas. The day before, because we met at the station, we all met at the station to go, he decided that he was going to go the last minute. But I did not know anything about the bank robbery, not involved in anything about the bank robbery, did not have any knowledge. He never said anything to me about a bank robbery, any of that nature.
The Vegas trip, you brought somebody with you?
Yes.
Who?
Myself, Sammy Martin, him, and Quesada.
So you have no idea what he did with all that money?
None.
Now you have to understand there is a concern here because it seems just remarkable, frankly, that you and Mac were partners, friends, involved in the shooting together, and both of you independently, you know, one became a bank robber and one became a drug dealer? That seems like a remarkable coincidence. And you're saying it is a coincidence.
I'm going to be put on a polygraph. Believe
yes.
I will, I will. I will be. I'm putting everything on the table. You guys think that David Mack is a very, very good friend of mine for some reason. Before we went on that Vegas trip, and after I stopped working with him in narcotics, I have seen David Mack maybe 4 or 5 times. Once was on a cruise. Once was we got together as a family, wives and family to... I've not... David Mack is a friend and a person who saved my life. I don't know if you know about that incident.
Yeah.
I had a gun to my head and he did what, you know, what, you know.
So that OIS report was true?
Oh, that's very accurate and very true, yes. All of it. I mean, that's all true. So I consider him a very good friend who saved my life. Was I involved in that bank robbery? No. Was this a big coincidence that we both end up in this kind of trouble or he ends up in that type of trouble? And it's a very big coincidence.
Now, basically, he's just talking about the quote-unquote coincidence of another partner of his, David Mack, who I mentioned before, Mack being a bank robber and him being a drug dealer. of course, I don't buy the thing that he didn't know that Mack did it. He may not have been involved in that particular bank robbery, but when the cops came up to him to arrest him about the cocaine theft, and him saying, is this about the bank robbery? Gives him an indication that he knew a little more than what he was letting on. But once again, this is all par for the course of what is intentionally being unleashed within the black community. They want these types of desperados there. These desperados may be going out doing their own little thing for their own little purposes, but the overall structure and coordinating hands of this martial law order know that they're serving their purpose overall, even if they don't understand the chaos and destruction that they're bringing down on black folks, as Perez himself goes into through his experience at Rampart. An experience that through the midst of all of that, you still have had and will have within these martial law orders certain landmarks. 7th Street and Willow, this is where in October of 67 Huey gunned down that little punk cop Frey who was trying to wreak havoc through the streets of West Oakland. On 10th Street and Center is where Huey died in West Oakland. 1276, 1276 10th Street was the Black Panther Party West Oakland Community Center. 14th Street and Jefferson was where the Panthers had the shoe factory and printing press. 18th Street and Adeline, of course, is the Infirmary Park, what we call Little Bobby Hutton Park, the first Panther killed in the line of duty. 19th Street and Telegraph is the Fox Oakland Theater, where different shows and things and presentations were outlined. 1218 28th Street in West Oakland is where Bobby was assassinated. 1048 Peralta Street in West Oakland became the Panther Central Headquarters. This was a move to relocate it back into, so to speak, the people's area. The reason why I mention this is this was done and continues to be done within the mechanisms of the martial law order against black folks. We don't need no little cosmic videotape telling us of what 322 connection that Boy George has hooked up to understand that the beast is in our neighborhood every day, and we know who's tugging on his leash. Hold on a sec.
Don't mess with black people. If you're black, don't mess with whites.
I think what's happening is the picture is just race is the issue of race in law enforcement. It's always been there, but I think the people that are now heading the law enforcement department are less sensitive to race now. For example, Janet Reno is the owl head in the U.S. Department of Justice, and we have written Janet Reno. We've written her letters. We've told her that there's a clear impact, disparate impact of treatment when it came down to African Americans in the agency, as well as Hispanics. Just to give you an example, in New York here, the white officers were shooting at a picture of Dr. Martin Luther King on a gun range. To me, that sends the message right there in a nutshell, if you want to say, that they just don't care. They really don't care about relations and race relations. We just recently had a gun planted in a federal courthouse near a prisoner to set up Steve Zanowicz. There was a gun placed in the courthouse near a vehicle. He was escorting a prisoner. He comes to his vehicle and basically there is a gun there. He reported this. There was no investigation done. This happened several months ago, and this was right at the height of his discrimination charges and complaints in the agency. So these are the types of things. What we're saying it's getting to the point now. It's very blatant. It's something serious is getting ready to occur.
I am. It's appalling what happened to Abner Valema, but I can truly say that I am not surprised, because these incidents occur across this nation every day of the year. In fact, as we speak, I'm sure some are occurring now. As an agent with the FBI, I was assigned at one time to look into civil rights matters, and I took several cases to the people in charge of the FBI headquarters. And on those occasions, they specifically told me that they weren't interested in civil rights matters, never have been, weren't now, and never would be. And they would only look into these matters in the case where they were pressured by the media or by public pressure. They said they had to establish a relationship with local police departments, with the National Academy, which is the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, where the FBI bring in police officers from around the nation to create this kind of camaraderie. In fact, it was created by Hoover to do just that, to join local police with federal police. And the supervisor at headquarters specifically told me that they would find it difficult to investigate police officers in brutality cases. And so the cases continue. And as I mentioned and talked about last year and documented and Primetime Live covered and did an independent investigation in Detroit, where Miles Green was beaten to death by two police officers. The FBI, just as they are doing in New York, opened a civil rights investigation. And then at the same time, they had the civil rights investigation going on in the FBI office. FBI agents were holding a fundraiser to pay for the defense of the police officers. So you have the FBI investigating, heading towards prosecution of the police officers, and at the same time raising money for their defense with flyers blatantly placed around the office. And you had members of the media come in to see these flyers, and they didn't care anything about it, because this is the way the system has worked, and this is the way it continues to work. The numbers indicate that. 1996, 11,721 complaints, civil rights complaints, most of them police brutality complaints. 2,000 of them are referred, of the 11,000, 2,000 are referred to prosecution, and less than 79 go to court. Out of 11,000 cases, 79 cases, most of them police brutality cases, end up in court, and many of them, you don't even, only 2% of them, you end up with convictions. Yeah, I think what's important is that, and this can be verified, at the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, they have a behavior science unit. And in that unit, profiles come out of that unit. During the time that I was an agent, profiles came out of that unit, and they actually profile African Americans in this country as a very emotional people. And the response to that, the strategic response out of the behavioral science unit, was that when issues come up like this, the beating of Abner Loima and other, the Miles Green case, that you respond to it in a fashion with press conferences, you create committees and task forces, and eventually it'll go away. The people will move on to another topic. Whereas if you had a scientific response, then there would be no quitting on the issue until you came to some kind of logical conclusion. Everything would be checked out. But they realized that an immediate response of creating task forces, saying the FBI are involved in this case, even with the statistics to show that nothing will probably be done, the immediate response will calm the public fears and send them on to other issues. And then in the end, nothing will be done about the case. And this is not me saying this. This is an FBI profile of what will happen in these major cases. And it comes from the Behavioral Science Unit at Quantico, Virginia, where their individuals paid to handle what is expected, to determine what will happen and what is the best response to incidents like this. And I'm sure over the last couple of weeks, numerous reports have come out. And the reality of the matter is, in more cases than not, they're not. We'll write about it early on, we'll talk about it on the radio, we'll talk about it on television, and then 6 months from now, we're on to another issue and the matter hasn't been resolved, and so the thing keeps going on over and over and over again throughout the nation.
Cover up, corruption, and the cops. The lone nut theory on American tradition. When the fallout over the Watergate-like Furman tapes took place, once again, the corporate-owned media, the cops, and the American politicians all began painting Mark DeFuhrer Furman as a rogue or lone cop, lone nut cop. This is the usual tactic by these prophets of deceit, and it's a lie. The role of the police has since its birth been a repressively violent institution whose role is to enforce by any means the laws of a ruling elite class and to protect the property of the state's ruling class. Now this ruling elite class, which has enslaved Africans, obliterated the Indians, supported and financed the Nazis, slaughtered millions of Vietnamese in Southeast Asia, and has done atomic radiation experiments on its own population in America, is in no position to rate or classify anyone else's conduct, lone nut or otherwise. But I'll let you be the judge. Philadelphia Inquirer, August 27, 1995. Quote, 5 murder cases may be tossed out. Now comes the murder cases. In the ever-widening wake of the 39th District Police corruption scandal, Philly judges have thrown out 42 drug convictions and may throw out hundreds more. Now defense lawyers say the taint has spread to 5 murder cases. Cops who today admit that they were crooked played a role in bringing charges in all 5 North Philadelphia slayings.
One former officer's longtime snitch said that she was secretly paid $500 to testify about a 1996 ballroom killing. In two other murder investigations, another crooked cop said that drugs had been planted to justify illegal searches. Evidence from those searches was used in court, unquote. Now, this all got started when a black grandmother, Betty Patterson, who after spending 3 years in prison was set free after her innocence was revealed by investigators who uncovered the fact that the police had framed up the black grandmother by planting drugs inside her home. Over 50 drug convictions have been overturned since the release due to perjured testimony and or police planted evidence. Quote, it keeps hemorrhaging, unquote, says Bradley Bridge, a local public defender. A grand jury investigating over 100,000 other arrests came through saying that what's most disturbing about the Philadelphia corruption scandal, noted legal scholar Lynn Washington, is that the DA knew what the cops were up to, but tolerated their use of planted evidence because it boosted their conviction rate, unquote. In February of 1995, other gangster cops were indicted on federal charges for conspiracy, obstruction of true justice, illegal searches, intimidation, theft of more than $100,000 in cash, and denying suspects their constitutional rights. Now this is the land of the, never mind, lone nut, or an American tradition. In New Orleans, 32-year-old Kim Groves was looking out her window when she witnessed two thugs in blue beating and pistol whipping in their proud tradition of Rodney King, a black teenager. Kim recognized one of the lowlifes as Officer Lynn Davis. He was an instructor in a safety course she had taken a little while back. Little did Kim know that she would need safety from this all-American cop. She filed a brutality complaint against the cops. Davis, who was already being wiretapped by the feds for trafficking drugs, was recorded giving Kim's description to his fellow friends in crime. As Kim was standing outside her home, 20 minutes later, Davis received a call back from those who are supposed to serve and protect. Well, the mission was served and fulfilled. They shot Kim Groves, mother of two, twice in the head. Quote, yeah, rock-a-bye, unquote, was Davis's cheerful declaration of independence. Independence of Kim's life and brutality complaint that was all recorded by accident by the FBI. In the past few years in New Orleans, headline scandals of the scandalous police have been rocking the Mardi Gras. Cops have been charged with armed robbery, kidnapping, battery, bribery, extortion, rape, and murder. In what has been ranked as one of the most brutal police departments in the county, Officer Antoinette Frank was found guilty robbing a restaurant and murdering three persons in the process. Lone nut, or an American tradition. In Chicago, they have their own Dr. Frankenstein, Mr. John Burge, who is trotting around torturing suspects and inmates with a homemade generator with wire clips that he would attach to your ears and genitals. Crank up the generator and watch you fry. It became so bad that Amnesty International listed this sadistic act as some of the worst in the world. Now in New York, the Mueller Commission brought out, amongst other things, that in Bronx's 48th precinct, the cops led by head Rambo cop Richard Rivera were busy getting drunk on duty, taking drugs, and plotting their next line of robberies and graft, until May 3rd of 1995 when 16 cops were arrested and indicted for an equal opportunity number of charges ranging from stealing weapons and money to illegally raiding apartments to falsifying evidence. But not to be outdone or outfinanced, cop Michael Carrizas later kept $1 million cash in his locker for his Cali drug cartel money laundering operation, according to federal investigators.
Now, down the road to the 75th Precinct in Brooklyn, Michael Dow and five other police drug dealers were arrested for cocaine trafficking in Suffolk County, Long Island. Cop Dow, who often rode around in a new red Corvette and could afford to have limos pick him up at the police station to chauffeur him to Atlantic City to gamble, never had any of his citizens file complaints against him investigated. So for the morgue boy cops from Brownsville, 73rd Precinct, who when they weren't robbing or shooting citizens, were according to the Mullen Commission report drinking and or snorting cocaine on duty, meeting with their girlfriends and or prostitutes, and shooting off their guns, to one precinct in New York, which was caught with its cops selling crack right out of the precinct. Lone nut. Or an American tradition. But the vicious institutionalized nature of the police has its origins embedded in America's barbaric history. Organized police forces and white supremacist organizations have their origins in approximately the same period, the Civil War years. The government during that period did not wield the power it wields today. The slave codes were enforced by the slave owners and their overseers, who would deputize slave patrols, i.e. cop patrols, from amongst the white male population. But after the conquest of Mexico, the abolition of slavery, and the destruction of the native population throughout North America, along with Sam's developing industrialization, more modern forms of controlling the American society and its people within it came into being. The Klan sprang out to re-disenfranchise the newly freed slaves during the Reconstruction period, to restore the old slaveocracy. It was during that period throughout the country that a permanent armed band of professional law enforcement groupings began to develop. The police departments were set up after the British model of constables on patrol, or cops, who were designed to maintain the existing order and to enforce the property relations of the elite class. Now, to maintain these racist, sexist, and at times genocidal institutions, you must attract people who have accepted and swallowed the indoctrination of this racist system and who will work as enforcers, i.e. cops, for it, which is suspiciously similar to the Klan and other white supremacist groupings like Mao, Men Against Women, and WASP, White Anglo-Saxon Policemen. In San Diego, a cop aligned with the Ku Klux Klan provides funds and radio equipment and helped gather ballot signatures for all American Aryan man Tom Mesker in his run for Congress. Old Mesker won the Democratic election but lost the general election. In San Bernardino, California, black cops seeking promotion are themselves sought out by the Brotherhood of Aryan Resistance, a supremacist cop grouping. The black cops find threatening letters in a secure area in the police. In L.A., after two cops are suspended for practicing a popular American pastime, burning a cross, and in this case, inside a jail facility, one of the cops, Brian Krumisky, later shoots and kills a Mexican national. It turns out that in a Peter Pitch jail facility, you have the white supremacist grouping of cops called the Wayside Whiteys. In East L.A., the white supremacist groups called the Caveman. And in Linwood Station, the white supremacist cop grouping is called the Vikings. In Florida, David Derminski, who was fired from the police force for flaunting a swastika tattoo at a Jewish female cop, seeks reinstatement with the honest statement that racism and Nazism are rampant on the police force. For proof, he provides a picture of two fellow officers dressed in Nazi uniforms that was in the chief of police's office. There's probably one in Boy George's overall office in the White House. Lone nut or an American tradition? I'll let you be the judge. This has been Tracy James with a commentary. Cover up corruption and the cops. The lone nut theory, or just a good old American tradition. Out.
Thank you.
that's just about going to wrap it up for Slade tonight. As it's clear that the martial law order that black folks have been facing is basically part of the black experience. Then and now. They're not taking any prisoners. So for the slave drivers out there, we're not taking any prisoners. And let the chips or bullets fall where they may. Until the next time, slave.